Philosophy of Mind, Lecture 7, Mind-Body Causation, Part 1.
In the last few lectures, we've been exploring alternatives to the substance dualism most famously associated with René Descartes, namely behaviorism, identity theory, and functionalism. The discussion of functionalism led us to our investigation of computer mentality, since in treating mental states as functional or causal states, functionalism makes room for the possibility that things other than our brains might have genuine mental states. But implicit in all this discussion, and occasionally explicit, was some conception of the nature of physical matter itself. After all, dualism insisted that a mind is a different kind of substance from matter, and you can't insist on that without saying a little something about the nature of each. Similarly, behaviorism, identity theory, and functionalism were all trying to reconcile the existence of minds or mental states with the physical world, but again, implicit there was the idea that the physical world itself isn't particularly problematic, and we ought, therefore, to expend most of our energy clarifying our conception of the mental. And in all these theories, of course, we've been looking at various aspects of the relationship between the physical and the mental. Well, no aspect of that relationship is A, more obvious, B, more important, and C, more problematic than the causal relationship between the physical and the mental. A, that mind-body causation is obvious. To speak of causation and causal relationships is to say that certain things cause or produce other things, and it seems simply undeniable that there's plenty of causation occurring between mind and body, or between the mental and the physical more generally. We may distinguish three different domains or areas of alleged causal interaction. First, mind-body, mind towards body. Here we refer to the fact that mental states or events seem to cause physical states or events. For example, I find myself feeling hungry, a mental sensation, and then my body begins moving towards the fridge. The feeling of hunger seems to have caused my physical body to move. Or my desire for a sales clerk's attention causes me to wave my arm. Or maybe I'm thinking of something sad and I begin to cry. My mental thought seems to have caused my physical tears. Clearly, we could multiply these examples at great length. Mind-body causation seems to be pervasive all over the place. Second, body-mind causation, body directed towards mind. Here we refer to the fact that physical states or events seem to cause mental states or events. Again, there are many examples. You are listening to this lecture. Air molecules are moving, which vibrate your ears, which make your neurons fire, all physical. But then you have the mental sensation of hearing my voice. And indeed, all of our external senses work the same way. Physical light causes physical reactions in eyeballs, causes physical neural firing, resulting in visual sensations. And ditto for our internal senses. That nasty fish that you might have physically eaten for lunch results in your feeling nausea, a mental sensation, and so on. So similarly, body towards mind causation seems to occur constantly and in many different forms, and its existence seems undeniable. And third, the third domain, is intramind causation. Here we refer to the fact that various mental states or events seem to cause other mental states or events. Again, plenty of examples. You might believe one thing because you believe some other thing. You might believe that this mess was created by your toddler because you also believe that he was in the room just moments ago. Or a thought might cause a desire. You think about Fig Newtons and suddenly find yourself desiring to grab a couple. Or a belief might cause a sensation. Your belief that your lottery ticket is a winner causes sensations of joy and elation. In general, the thoughts you're having at one moment seem to cause the subsequent thoughts in the next, and so on. So too, then, intramind causation seems frequent and undeniable. Putting these all together, then, mind-body causation, in which we'll include intramind causation, seems simply to be obvious. B, that mind-body causation is important. Why is it important? Only because it seems essential to our most basic conception of what we are as human beings, as persons. For no matter where you might stand on the mind-body problem, you're probably inclined to think that there are some crucial differences between human beings and, let's say, rocks or mud or plants or trees or even most other animals. For one thing, inanimate objects like stones and mud seem essentially passive. They do what they do because various things cause them to do it or the laws of nature make them do it. They don't on their own initiate anything. But we, in contrast, are capable of being active, of being agents who initiate actions. So too, unlike these other things, we're capable of having genuine perceptions of the world. Information about the world outside gets into us, gets processed, and is ultimately perceived by us. These other things, especially inanimate things, are perhaps the passive recipients of causal influences. Heat may make water hotter, for example, or sunlight may cause plants to grow. But we wouldn't say that the water perceives the heat, or that the plants perceive the sunlight. And finally, unlike these things, and presumably unlike most or maybe all animals, we are largely rational beings. We're capable of undergoing rather extended sequences of rational thought or deliberation, of generating hypotheses about things and testing them against the evidence, of reflecting on our experiences in various ways. And to say that is to say that there's more going on here than simply one thought being followed by another, being followed by another. Our thought processes can hang together, fit together, follow logically in various ways. So essential to our conception of ourselves is that we are agents capable of perception and rational reflection. And it turns out that mind-body causation is essential to all of those things. Mind-body causation and agency. What is it exactly to be an agent capable of initiating actions? Well, to perform an action involves at least causing the thing. We turn on the light, we make coffee, as opposed to merely, say, passively sweating from the heat or shivering from the cold. But we also must cause the thing in the right way. If I merely brush past the light switch flicking it on, I may have caused the light to come on, but we wouldn't think of that as an action I performed or initiated. Rather, I must cause the light to come on deliberately or intentionally, where that, in turn, means that I caused it to occur as a result, let's say, of my own beliefs and desires. I desire the room to light up. I believe that flicking the switch would light the room, and so I flick the switch. My flicking on the light switch is an action of mine because my belief-desire pair caused me to do the thing. But beliefs and desires are mental states, while light switch flicking is a physical action, so actions are only possible if mind-body causation is. What about mind-body causation and perception? Well, consider this question. What's the difference between merely hallucinating or dreaming of a given thing and genuinely perceiving it? Answer: in the latter case, the thing in question must actually and genuinely cause the perception of it. If you're having a visual experience of an apple tree, but this experience is generated entirely internally by your brain during dreaming, let's say, then that visual experience doesn't count as a genuine perception of that tree. But if the real existing physical tree causes the mental visual experience, it does count as a genuine perception. So perception, too, requires mind-body causation, or body-towards-mind causation, just as much as agency does. What about mind-body causation and rational deliberation? Well, our capacity for deliberation distinguishes us from most or all other animals, and at least part of what rational deliberation involves is that our thought sequences hang together, as we said. Well, one component of hanging together seems to be that thoughts are causally responsible for subsequent thoughts. For imagine for a moment that your state of thinking at one moment literally had no causal relevance to your state of thinking at the next moment. It's hard to imagine that the two thoughts involved at those two moments would or could have anything to do with each other. They'd seem to be just randomly paired thoughts. So if our thoughts do hang together, one mechanism would be that the first thought literally causes the second thought. Rational deliberation, then, seems to depend on what we called intra-mind causation. Putting all three of these together, mind-body causation is essential to our very conception of ourselves as human beings, as persons, and that's why it's important. C. That it's problematic. That shall be the general theme of today's lecture, so let's get right to it. The mind-body problem. Back in Lecture 2, we examined a couple of problems for Cartesian substance dualism, the doctrine that mind and matter are completely different sorts of substances. Well, no problem has had more historical traction than the causation problem, which is often just called the mind-body problem. It's this: if your mind really is completely separate and distinct from your body and brain, then how exactly can or do they causally interact? How could mental states or events cause physical states or events, and vice versa? There are actually two aspects of this problem. First, neuroscience has learned much about the physical processes of the brain and about how brain states cause subsequent brain states. But how could Cartesian mental states causally intervene in the brain without totally undermining everything that science teaches us about causation within the brain? How can we reconcile mind-body causation, in other words, with the purely physical causation of neuroscience? That's the first aspect. Second aspect of the problem, is mind-body causation even intelligible? How could a non-spatial mind on the Cartesian picture, having no spatial properties or even a spatial location, recall, have any interactions with the spatial body or the physical molecules of the brain? It seems quite literally inconceivable or unintelligible to us. Descartes misunderstood response to the mind-body causation problem. Descartes himself was by no means unaware of the causation problem confronting his dualism, and in fact he offered a response to it, one which it turns out is quite frequently misrepresented. The way the story is often told, Descartes attempted to solve the mind-body problem by pointing to a small gland in the brain, now known as the pineal gland, and asserting that mind-body causation occurs at this gland. And indeed, he does quite clearly hold that this gland is where mind-body causation occurs. He describes in surprising detail how this gland can be pushed and pulled and compressed and expanded and moved in all sorts of ways, and then how different states of this physical gland result in different mental perceptions. And he also describes how different mental states can in turn cause the pineal gland to get moved and compressed and expanded in various ways, which in turn physically causes bodily motions. So indeed, the pineal gland plays a central role in mind-body causation for Descartes. Of course, the problem is that invoking the pineal gland doesn't solve the causation problem. We still have no explanation for how a physical state can cause a mental state or vice versa. We've merely located the problem at the gland. And so Descartes is often pilloried or ridiculed for offering a solution to the mind-body problem, which simply isn't a solution at all. The real story, however, is more subtle and complex than this. But before we get there, let's explore a couple of alternative views on mind-body causation that were very much on the table, particularly in Descartes' own era in the 17th and 18th centuries. Alternative causal theory number one, Nicolas Malebranche and occasionalism. Nicolas Malebranche was a 17th century French thinker who was probably the most important French thinker after Descartes, both chronologically and in terms of fame and influence. That fact isn't fully appreciated in the English-speaking world, unfortunately, because many of Malebranche's extensive writings remain, even to this day, untranslated. Indeed, chances are that you've never heard his name, even if you had heard of Descartes before listening to these lectures, even though Malebranche was just as famous as Descartes in his own time. What's most interesting about Malebranche, for me anyway, is that he's associated with a number of philosophical doctrines which at first blush seem really quite strange. And yet when you read his works, you discover that his was a brilliant intellect and that he offers extremely powerful arguments for his otherwise very counterintuitive doctrines. Perhaps none of his doctrines is stranger than his own entry into the mind-body causation discussion, a doctrine known as occasionalism. Occasionalism asserts very simply that no ordinary things like minds and bodies, have genuine causal powers. Instead, it holds, God alone is the single true cause of everything that occurs. So, for example, your desire for a snack seems to result in your body's moving towards the fridge, but it's not the case that your desire causes your body to move. Rather, according to occasionalism, your desire is the occasion upon which God himself causes your body to move. Similarly, your sniffing the garlic clove does not cause your mind to experience the perception of the pungent aroma. It's merely the occasion upon which God himself causes your perception. So ordinary minds and bodies, rather than being true causes of anything, are merely the occasions for God's genuine causality. Hence the label occasionalism. Now, however you might feel about this doctrine on my initial sketch of it, do at least note one of its virtues. It solves the mind-body problem, or perhaps more precisely, dissolves it. To solve it would be to explain just how mind and body can causally interact. Instead, on the doctrine of occasionalism, there's no need to explain how they interact because they simply don't. The problem just goes away. Your desire to eat results in God's moving your body. No problem. Of course, some philosophers think that this doctrine is just too simple. It does feel a little ad hoc, after all. You just invoke God when you need to explain something. And of course, you can only believe in occasionalism if you happen to already be a believer in God in the first place. So if you happen to be an atheist, you're just out of luck here. If you are a believer, however, it's worth pointing out that occasionalism is not quite as ad hoc as it might sound in my description of it so far. First, it doesn't actually originate with Malebranche, although he is the philosopher most famously associated with it. In fact, occasionalism dates at least back to the early medieval period, when it was taken very seriously by many thinkers long before the specific mind-body problem arose, at least in its Cartesian dualist form. More importantly, and perhaps the reason that Malebranche is most closely associated with occasionalism, the doctrine is actually based on a number of sophisticated arguments which make it more broadly applicable than merely to the mind-body causation issue. Rather, it's in fact a very general theory of causation. The argument is that no ordinary objects, like minds and bodies, have true causal powers, so no purely physical causation is possible either. Thus, Malebranche argues, when one billiard ball collides with another, the motion of the first does not truly cause the motion of the second. Rather, the collision is the occasion on which God himself subsequently moves the second ball. And if you're the one shooting, you obviously hope he drops it in the pocket. So the theory, at least, is not ad hoc. It's not merely invoked to make the mind-body problem go away. It's really a general theory of causation. It's in fact based on various arguments about causation in general, and then has the added benefit that if you accept those arguments, if you can accept this doctrine, you can make the mind-body causation problem just go away. And indeed, if you are a believer in God, it is a theory which you must consider carefully. And I heartily commend to you the writings of Malebranche, which are available in English if you want to explore some of his really quite fascinating arguments for occasionalism. Alternative causal theory number 2, G.W. Leibniz and pre-established harmony. We meet Leibniz once again, the great 17th century German mathematician and philosopher. In lecture 4, we discussed his principle of identity, known as Leibniz's law. And in our last lecture, on computer minds, we discussed his invention of a mechanical device for performing mathematical computations. It's actually no surprise that Leibniz might come up frequently, for no matter what subject you study, you're likely to come across him at some point, for he made important contributions throughout mathematics and many different sciences, including inventing the famous theory known as the calculus, as well as made contributions in philosophy and theology and other subjects. He was also famous for wearing one of the biggest wigs in Europe, but that's a subject for another day. Perhaps none of his theories is as interesting or as bizarre as his doctrine of the pre-established harmony. Imagine two grandfather clocks, exactly identical in every way, wound the same way, and set to precisely the same time. What we'd expect to see is a perfect correlation between the two clocks. When the first one reads 12:13, so too would the second, and so on. But this perfect correlation is not evidence of any direct causal relationship between the clocks. The readings on one clock in no way cause the readings on the other, despite their perfect correlation. Rather, their respective readings are caused purely internally by the internal mechanisms of each clock. The correlations obtain because they've been, in this case, externally coordinated. They run in perfect parallel, in a kind of harmony of correlation, and yet causally separated from each other. Well, that now is Leibniz's picture of the world as a whole. There appears to be plenty of causal interaction between minds and bodies, as we've seen. But this appearance, he says, is an illusion. Your desire for a snack may well be correlated with your body's moving towards the fridge, but it does not, in fact, cause it. Instead, each individual substance causes its own sequence of internal states. Your mind causes itself to go through a sequence of mental states, including desires, thoughts, perceptions, and so on. Your mind is running on a purely internal program, much as each grandfather clock did in the previous example. Meanwhile, The physical world, including your body, is running on its own internal program, going through a sequence of physical states. And those sequences of events are all perfectly correlated with each other. At the moment your mind's program produces its desire for food, your body's program produces the motion towards the fridge. All individual minds, too, are in perfect correlation or harmony with each other. At the moment your mind produces in you the perception of calling my name, my mind produces in me the perception of your voice calling my name. Each individual thing runs its own internal program, yet everything is so perfectly correlated or harmonized that we get the illusion of causal interaction between things. This doctrine, this pre-established harmony, is admittedly not an idea you come across every day. But whatever you may think of it on this brief introduction, do note that it, too, dissolves the Cartesian mind-body causation problem in just the same way as occasionalism did. If there really isn't any such thing as mind-body causation, then there's no problem about how they interact. But unlike occasionalism, pre-established harmony doesn't deny that minds and bodies have any causal powers whatsoever. Minds can genuinely cause their own internal mental states, much as we've seen in our presentation of intra-mind causation, and bodies genuinely have the power to cause their own physical states. Now, there's lots more that could be said here, of course. Leibniz believes, for example, that such a system, which would involve the incalculable coordination of the programs of uncountably many distinct substances, could only have been set up by God, who made sure in advance to establish these correlations in the name of an orderly world. And that's why, in fact, he often refers to the system as that of pre-established harmony. God sets up the correlations in advance. But while Leibniz's doctrine might appeal most readily to someone who is already a believer in God, it doesn't strictly rely on belief in God the way that occasionalism did, which explicitly invoked God's causal workings in the world. In fact, Leibniz offers a whole variety of arguments for his position, including critiques of his various competitors, the dualism's claim of causal interaction and occasionalism's claim of God intervening. And so whether you ought to accept Leibniz's doctrine would depend on engaging with all of those arguments. Again, I heartily commend to you the relevant writings of Leibniz, one of the greatest minds in Western intellectual history. But for now, just note that Leibniz's doctrine, too, offers an alternative to the Cartesian dualist picture. There's no mind-body causation, thus no problem. And for some, indeed, that might be reason enough to prefer Leibniz's pre-established harmony theory to Descartes' own. Which returns us, of course, to the question of what precisely Descartes' own theory is. He, Malebranche, and Leibniz all share the mind-body dualism which generates the problem in the first place. They differ only in what they say about mind-body causation. We left off suggesting that Descartes invoking the pineal gland was generally misrepresented and misunderstood, and that his true doctrine is more subtle and complex. So what was it? Descartes' real position on the pineal gland. The pineal gland is important to understanding Descartes, but not for the reason many think. Their misunderstanding is in thinking that Descartes offered the pineal gland as a solution to the mind-body causation problem. But the truth is that he offered it only as the location for the problem, as the place where mind and body, in particular mind and brain, interact. And he actually had several reasons for locating the interaction precisely at this gland. Here's just one. Philosophers had long been aware of a certain problem in understanding perception. We have two eyes, for example, but what we typically perceive are not two distinct images, but rather one unified visual perception of our surroundings. So, too, we have two ears, and yet we don't typically hear two distinct sounds. The problem is how and why the multiplicity of sensory organs here does not result in a multiplicity of perceptual experiences. More generally still, we have multiple senses and sensory organs and sensory pathways in the brain, and yet we're very good at realizing which sensory inputs belong together. We easily recognize that the garlic clove we're seeing with our eyes, and the one we're touching with our hands, and the one whose aroma we're sniffing, are all one and the same. But how can we recognize this if the visual and tactile and smell information all travel along entirely distinct, separate pathways? One natural theory was that perhaps the information from the two eyes, or the two ears, ultimately gets merged somewhere in the brain and synthesized together, and then in turn the information from all the senses also gets merged somewhere as well. Well, according to the 17th century's understanding of brain anatomy, much of the brain was symmetric, with many of its parts duplicated. Today, for example, we speak of the left and right hemispheres, which look to be roughly duplicates of each other, even though we know they differ in various ways. The pineal gland stood out in that picture as a brain organ which was not duplicated, and yet which was closely connected to both hemispheres. Thus Descartes reasons, quite reasonably in fact, that the pineal gland might be the place where distinct information from all the different sensory organs comes together. And if all that information comes together there, wouldn't that be the most logical place for the physical brain to convey that information to the mind, in order to generate the single unified perception we typically enjoy of the world? The point, then, is that Descartes offered very good reasons, scientific reasons, to believe that the pineal gland is the where, the location, of mind-body causal interaction. But he was not, in his discussions of this gland, even remotely attempting to explain the how of mind-body causal interaction. The plot and the problem thicken. But now it gets more complicated before it gets simpler. There's a fascinating passage in the sixth and final meditation in Descartes' most famous work, Meditations on First Philosophy. Much of this short book provides the materials for the mind-body dualism we've associated with Descartes' name throughout these lectures. But then suddenly, out of the blue, Descartes writes the following, quote, "Nature also teaches me, by these sensations of pain, hunger, thirst, and so on, that I am not merely present in my body as a sailor is present in a ship, but that I am very closely joined and, as it were, intermingled with it, so that I and the body form a unit. If this were not so, I, who am nothing but a thinking thing, would not feel pain when the body was hurt, but would perceive the damage purely by the intellect, just as a sailor perceives by sight if anything in his ship is broken. Similarly, when the body needed food or drink, I should have an explicit understanding of that fact instead of having confused sensations of hunger and thirst." End quote. Why is this so surprising? Well, dualism, as we've presented it, seems very much to be captured by the analogy of a sailor in a ship. The mind can observe or perceive what's going on in the body, and of course the mind, in general, controls or directs the body, for example by sending it to the fridge for a snack. And yet here Descartes rejects that otherwise very natural analogy with some interesting observations. If the mind were truly and completely distinct from the body, he observes, then it might perhaps know when the body suffered an injury, much as the sailor observes the hole in the hull of the ship and says to himself, "Must fix that," so the mind might observe the nail penetrating the body's foot, to use my favorite example, and say to itself, "Oh, must get that fixed." But of course, that's not what our experience is like. Rather than observe that we are injured, it hurts. Similarly, the mind might well know when the body needs food or drink, roughly the same way we know that it's time to fill up our car with gas. But instead, our experience isn't that we merely know that we must eat. Rather, we feel hungry. This leads Descartes to the quite striking conclusion that mind and body are not completely separate after all, despite the famous dualism. Rather, he says, they are closely joined or intermingled. This should lead us to recognize two things. First, what Descartes is invoking here are what we earlier called qualia, the what it's like to be in certain mental states, such as sensations like pain and hunger. And second, if we want to appreciate Descartes' real theory of mind-body causation, we'll have to recognize that he doesn't quite take dualism to mean that the mind and body are utterly separate from each other. Rather, the existence of qualia as just described is going to play some important role. Descartes' real position on the mind-body problem. The real position is going to sound anticlimactic. But you know, after all the strange doctrines we've been looking at in this lecture, maybe a little anticlimax could be a good thing. Descartes' real position on mind-body causation is just this. We don't know how mind and body interact. Or perhaps more accurately, we don't really need to know how they interact. That might sound like a cop-out, but it really isn't. For consider first a different question. How exactly do physical objects causally interact amongst themselves in purely physical exchanges? For example, when two billiard balls collide, how exactly does the motion of the first bring about the motion of the second? The short answer is, in the 17th century and arguably even today, nobody really knows. We might invoke the laws of motion to explain, but of course no one really understands why those laws take precisely the form they do. And moreover, the laws of motion seem merely to summarize or describe the motions that occur, not cause those motions. And further still, our glimpses of Malebranche and Leibniz reveal that the idea that physical objects have true causal powers over one another is actually quite problematic, enough so that both these great minds, amongst others, argue against it. The point we might conclude here is this. In any investigation, even of the purely physical world, you reach a point where you must admit certain primitives, facts or phenomena for which no further explanation is possible. You might explain why bodies move the way they do by invoking the laws of motion, but then you simply accept the laws of motion as a basic fact about how the universe is made. Or if you find some way of explaining why the laws of motion exist and take the form they do, then that new thing you invoke is taken as just a basic fact. And if you're a believer in God, you might take your science extremely far, but then just conclude, and that's just the way God made the world, no further explanation available. In fact, the idea that all explanations ultimately end in inexplicable primitives remains a hotly discussed issue to this day in contemporary philosophy of science. And certainly in the 17th century, it was more than reasonable to conclude about the physical world that some of its features were basic and primitive, that that's just the way God made the world, no further explanation available. Well then, Descartes' view about mind-body causal interaction is precisely the same. That mental states and events can cause physical states and events, and vice versa, is a primitive feature of the world. Just as God constructed the world with various laws of motion governing physical bodies, so too, he constructed the world with various laws governing how minds and bodies interact, establishing, for example, that when the pineal gland is compressed a certain way, then some corresponding mental perception occurs, and that when the mind is desiring a snack, then some corresponding pineal gland compression occurs, and so on. If accepting primitives is good enough in physics for purely physical interactions, then it should be good enough for mind-body interactions as well. So in short, we don't really know how mind and body interact, says Descartes. But then again, we don't really know how bodies interact either. But the fact that we don't know the latter doesn't stop us from accepting that bodies do causally interact, or from doing a tremendous amount of science and working out the precise laws governing those interactions, and so it needn't stop us from the same with respect to mind-body interaction. Conclusion. Descartes recognizes that the mind-body relation is really quite complex. Mind does not stand to body like a sailor to a ship, but is rather intermingled with it, despite also being a separate substance. What Descartes was observing, again, was that mental phenomena have a qualitative aspect, qualia. There's something that it's like to experience them. Well, as we've seen, and we'll see in more detail in later parts of the course, qualia are a kind of two-edged sword. On the one hand, they provide the strongest arguments for dualism in the first place, since their existence seems impossible to accommodate within a purely physical world. But on the other hand, understanding precisely how qualia fit into this physical world, understanding how the physical processes of the brain might produce or interact with qualia, remains perhaps the most impenetrable part of understanding the relationship between mind and body or brain. It's fair to say that to this very day, no one has any understanding of the nature of qualia and their relationship to the brain, even as the existence of qualia provide the strongest evidence that the mind is something different from the brain. So the final point to make in Descartes' defense is this. Way ahead of his time, he recognized in qualia both the best evidence and the biggest difficulty for dualism. And his inability to explain precisely how qualia fit into the physical world can hardly be held against him, for it puts him in company with precisely every thinker who thinks about these issues to this very day. We'll return to the question of mind-body causation in Lecture 13, when we'll explore some more contemporary thinkers on the topic. First, in our next lecture, we'll resume the thread that we left dangling at the end of our last lecture, Lecture 6. We'd concluded there that the meaningfulness of mental states, the fact that they're about things, was essential to them. We must now spend some time trying to make sense of, in a word from earlier in the course, the intentionality of the mental.
This ends Lecture 7.